and welcome to Untold. We are back after a fantastic couple of days at Bread and Jam, where I headed down and hosted a couple of panels. We spoke to some fantastic entrepreneurs and heard some talks from leaders, investors, from Jason and Tara, who run it. It was just a really great buzz. And following on from that, I'm super excited. We've got a great guest on today. Her name's Zara Roberts, and she runs Healthy Nibbles. And I can't wait to get stuck into this conversation. So let's get going. Zara, how are you doing?
I'm good. It sounds like Bread and Jam was awesome.
It was fantastic. It was one of those times where there's quite a lot of sort of uncertainty and nervousness in our industry with everything that's going on and cost of goods, et cetera, et cetera. Inflation going on. And it was just 2 days of positivity, which was just really nice to kind of get involved in and come out and go, you know what? Let's go again. And it just I feel re-energized, actually.
Brilliant.
That's great. But how are you? How's everything going?
Yeah, we've had our ups and downs as many of us, but yeah, there's a positive outlook. And I think, as with anyone, it's just staying vigilant to the ongoing changes and just continually adapting.
Absolutely. I love that, continually adapting. Amazing. Well, look, if we kick off, it'd be great to hear a little bit about you, your career so far, how you came to Healthy Nibbles, and sort of give us a bit of colour behind yourself.
Yeah, so I'm fairly new to this industry, really. So we've been running Healthy Nibbles since 2015-ish, give or take. Idea was concepted a year or so earlier. And prior to that, I ran a brand and semiotics agency in sub-Saharan Africa and the Gulf. So very, very different. When I returned from Africa, I really didn't have the same passion about brand in the same way that you should do when you're operating in it daily. I completely value brand, as you would expect, but I just didn't want to go back into that industry when I came back over here. But I was a bit lost in terms of what to do and that sort of reapplication of skills. And then it was actually a really sort of sad story, personal experience that paved the way for Healthy Nibbles. So my dad was in hospital in palliative care.
Yeah.
And spent a long time in hospitals, went to a vending machine in the middle of the night, and there's the usual unhealthy products in there. Yeah. And then next to it was a poster saying diabetes and obesity kill.
Oh my word.
And I just thought in that moment, that whole sort of juxtaposition between this is what we're preaching, but this is what we're delivering.
Yeah.
But then even just as I sort of pondered that thought, ambled back through the wards and just saw the pressure that the nurses are under and the people that are looking after the people in hospital, the patients, and what they were being fed on and what they could access. So that then started the whole cycle into actually, we expect high performance, we deliver food that is unhealthy and doesn't support productivity in the immune system, so we need to change that. And that's how Healthy Nibbles began.
Wow, what a story. That is amazing. And I think it's someone that everybody can relate to, because I think when it's like during the pandemic, right, the nursing and hospitals and everything was shone such a bright light on that people went out and actively did stuff towards it. Like I remember at our neighbors on our road baking cakes and taking in healthy fruit and veg for the nurses and the doctors and all the staff that worked there. And there was an amazing campaign that I think was run by EasyJet, or maybe it was run by one of their pilots, and they set up basically what they called like the first class lounge in I think it was Tooting Hospital, and got a load of kind of healthy food in and ran like a kind of pop-up restaurant for these for all the staff. I think it's amazing. And you're so right. It's something that when the light's not being sort of shone quite as bright, it's not front of mind anymore, is it? So that's amazing. And I think a story that everyone can relate to and fantastic. And so I guess if you can kind of sort of from that moment of kind of idea, conception, there's clearly something that is sort of batting against each other here and something that needs to be fixed. What happened next? How did you go about kind of sort of what once the idea had come out, how did you go about getting to the point of sort of setting up?
So the setting up was actually quite a challenge because a lot of the vending companies are actually aligned to unhealthy brands. So to do that whole sort of MVP, I was like, could we lease a machine? Could we try doing X, Y, Z? And we just were getting knocked back all the time. Yeah. Shows my lack of knowledge in the vending industry at the time. So I was like, is that how it works? So we ended up getting a bank loan and going and buying a vending machine and thinking, well, you know, to heck with it. We'll just put our own stuff in. So we just bought one, and actually it was great. Our first site was the BBC in Glasgow, the Pacific Quay. So that was an amazing site. Going and getting products was really interesting as well. I felt really nervous going out to brands and saying, could you send me samples? I was like, they're not going to send me free products. I just obviously did not know the whole how to buy in that context. So that was quite interesting. We got together a few basics to trial, but even that was a continually evolving set of metrics that we work to in terms of definition of healthy and all of those sorts of things. Yeah. We first worked with a nutritionist that had a very, very strict response to it. And I kid you not, nobody would be eating anything but coconut water and seaweed. That's kind of it. You know, and for us, it was about behavior change. It was increasing the, you know, increasing healthy access, but you can't go into somebody who's had ultra high processed foods and then give them a carrot. It's not going to work.
No, absolutely. So we
just set about reaching out to brands that were really obvious at the time, which, I mean, it's not that long ago in the scale of building a business, but it seems ages away, you know. There weren't that many challenger brands, or there didn't seem to be as many challenger brands.
So
going out to those, speaking to them, getting those products in, and then just seeing how that worked. Did people buy? And we found very quickly that they did, and that it was a demand. I think we've got on a journey since, defining what healthy is. How do we move with the times? We've seen paleo come and go. We've seen vegan and plant-based take a totally different mix. We've seen gut health emerge. So there's lots of different trends, and that's something that we try and stay on top of by externally verifying what's healthy. But it was just a very nerve-wracking start of how does this work? And then just into the basics of running a business like this. Who services the machine? Where do we get, who refills it? What happens if it breaks down?
Yeah.
All of those things. So there's quite a lot of moving parts from a very early start. And it did give me insight into why there hasn't been more competition in this space, because it is actually incredibly challenging. There's so many different moving parts to it.
Oh my word, 100%. And I think there's so much in that to unpick. I mean, the first thing for me that I absolutely love on with guests that we get on, and kind of the challenger industry that we're in, is like the vending machines didn't want healthy, so we just went and got a loan and bought a vending machine. It's like, I know like we all get sort of wrapped up in those conversations where everyone's sort of going out and just finding, solving solutions, but when you break it down and take it out and out of our industry, it's like, it's amazing, it's fantastic. And I think the other thing there is sort of defining what healthy is, right? And that is such a big challenge. Like, I wish I'd been a fly on the wall when you're having those conversations, because we, as a team at The Savourist, we do that as well. Like, we started with a super healthy product that just didn't taste very nice. Like, because it was, we were like, what it in the trade, what you think is healthy versus what consumers think are healthy are just completely different things.
Yeah.
And you're so right. And it's like finding that balance of, actually, you like food and snacks and vending is always has to be that kind of what we call at The Savourist is like a jiggly moment, where you sort of like you're like, oh yeah, I do want that, and like, yes, it's better for me, but I'm still looking forward to eating it. And and it's amazing. And so what were your kind of key findings? I mean, I'm sure this project was huge, and I'm sort of asking you to distill it in like a sentence, but like, what were your sort of key findings to that in terms of what classifies as kind of like healthy but mass market healthy that would work in the machines?
So I think there were actually two or three things. I think at the point of starting, we saw paleo come and go very quickly. And it by no means has disappeared, but it's not, it was at the forefront of the same way that plant-based is now, but it didn't have the sticking power.
Okay.
Essentially.
Yeah.
And it didn't, I guess it didn't have the climate and the that sustainability message behind it. It was just a single dietary trend. So we saw it come really quickly, go really quickly. And that got me thinking around how do we protect ourselves against the ebbs and flows of media trends around diet? Because we all know fat's in 1 minute, out the next, sugar's in 1 minute. You know, it's just, it's crazy. The other thing was behavior change. So how do you get somebody who's, you know, I always say the story. One of my biggest wins is a kid who was on 10 Red Bull a day, managed to get him onto 10 Tenzing. And I'm quite sure that even Tenzing wouldn't recommend 10 Tenzings a day. Yeah. But the fact that we were able to get him to pivot from one highly, highly chemical driven product into a more natural base for me was a huge win.
Yeah, amazing. So
what we did is we set our strict non-negotiables. And then when we onboard a brand, we actually benchmark it against about 15 different nutritional standards around the world.
Amazing.
And then if a company or a client comes to us and says, right, I don't know, we want to be well-building certified, then we can go to that framework and say, right, this is the products that you need in the machine to be well-building certified. Or if you want to be sugar-wise, or if you want World Health Organization, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And that's how we've done it. So we've taken out all the nasties. So palm oil, artificial ingredients, sweeteners, hydrogenated fats.
Yeah.
That is an absolute no. And then after that, it's benchmarking with the latest research. We find that because it's going to keep us protected in the future.
Yeah.
Because, as knowledge comes, you know, more wisdom around what we should and shouldn't be eating, then we can always be benchmarking against that. Maybe. And so some sites, we also have an 80-20 rule. And that'll be 20% naughty, but we absolutely have to be sustainable on that side.
Yeah.
So Tony's Chocolonely, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Where it's still a naughty product, but, you know, or an indulgent product, it's not a naughty product, is it? We all like our treats.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's keeping that balance, because what we're not trying to fuel, which is, again, a lesson right at the beginning, when we said healthy, we had so many people that had anorexia and things like that, that had those issues coming to us and following. We only had it for a period of time, but it really gave me, I got a real sort of conviction of, I've got to look after these people. You know, probably not mine, but it was something that I felt responsible for. I want to be able to present a business that is doing good by, societal needs, climate, but also not provoking, unhealthy eating behaviors.
Yeah. Amazing. I love that. It's such a fine balance between the two. Right. And I can imagine, I mean, the split, that sort of 80-20 split, I can imagine the repeat purchase rate on the 20% is probably pretty high. Right.
Yeah, it is. It depends on the sites. I think I guess we attract a lot of clients that are looking at that balance element.
Yeah.
And it's not just on the food, but even so considerate. So we're 100% cashless most.
We
are now. We're 100% cashless. But at one point with one of our clients, they had an employee who'd had an issue with gambling and had gone on to cash purchases only and got rid of all credit cards. So they made us put cash in there.
Wow.
Just for this one individual.
Yeah.
And I just think that's really, really good that they actually came to us. They trusted us with that information. We obviously didn't know the individual, but trusted us with that information. And we were able to accommodate. So I think, it's just about really looking after these, after employees or after people that are our customers.
It's amazing. And there's a huge piece in that around relationships. Like, what a fantastic relationship you've built with that client for them to be able to come to you and say, look, there is an issue. Can we solve it? And for you to be able to go out and solve it. I absolutely love the story. And I think it's a perfect time to kind of maybe fast forward a bit and get to a point where when we spoke before recording this, we were speaking about sort of, as the business grows, building out your sort of senior team, your wider team, and the importance of values-based business at the core and sticking to that. I mean, it is such a broad topic that it's quite difficult to kind of condense down into a question. But I guess if you speak about your journey putting together a leadership team and a board and the key takeaways that you've had from that, the sort of ups and the downs and the learnings that you've had from pulling all that together, and then we can kind of intertwine how important the values piece is after that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. I think our team has definitely ebbed and flowed in terms of size. We've been between sort of 6 and 13. And I've got a huge amount of takeaways from that experience. I would say one of the big ones was looking at individuals that had applied for a job that had come from big corporates. And I know as a sort of early, you know, first-time founder, you can get a bit glassy-eyed with that. It's a bit, yeah, hey, this is going to be brilliant. They can bring some of that large professional experience and help support the growth. It doesn't work. For the vast majority, it doesn't work. In fact, that experience actually at one point in our journey nearly killed the team completely. Wow. So we were going through quite a critical point of investment. And if any of the founders listening know that experience, it's all in. Yeah. You don't have a minute to think. And before that, I'd actually recruited two key people with the remit of recruiting another two under them. And got them on board, thought they were absolutely fantastic, and it was an absolute train wreck completely. The culture just was not there. It was, why don't you have this? It was like a constant criticism. Like, why don't you have an IT department? Why don't you have a HR department? It's like, there's only seven of us. I really don't think we need it. Don't think we're that big to have a HR department.
Just hand out your mobile number. Here we go. Here's IT. Here's HR.
You know, like, this doesn't work. That doesn't work. How would this work? And then we had a very difficult situation where they were just not embedded with the values. They were disrupting and creating a really negative culture. Didn't really take any of our strict sort of like non-negotiables, didn't take that to heart at all. I'll be all right. To the point where it got very, very toxic. And there was one day in particular that really stood out where I was getting ready to go to work and I thought, I don't actually want to go to the office because I can't deal with the crap that's coming. And I thought, just a sec, whose business is this? Who founded this business? And I'm dreading going into my own office.
Yeah.
And we pulled the plug. Not only on the individual, but it trickled on with the four, and we actually lost four within 2 months.
Oh my word.
Interestingly, after that experience, the amount of suppliers and advisors that came to me and said, thank goodness you've got rid of that person.
Yeah.
He was incredibly toxic. And that's why you didn't get X. That's why it was quite a revelation how you can have one person come in and be so influential when the founder is not there.
Yeah.
To create a subculture almost within the culture. And that was a really, really scary moment. But I do think as you go on this journey, if you are looking to create a scalable business and you need a wider team, it's beyond imperative that you've got to find people that can reflect the values that you're creating.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're sending out a promise, and this is what we're going to do as a brand, as a business. But then if you then, as the founder, go on and do different aspects of that business and you leave this team or some of this team to be getting on with other aspects, they absolutely have to be underpinning everything that you've built naturally, not in a forced or contrived way. It just has to be embedded in them. Otherwise, those shortcuts can creep in and the brand can be diluted very, very quickly by a team that's not passionate about your mission and your vision and your goals.
So, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's one of the hardest things, I think, out there in terms of that scale-up process, because you're so right. It's, I mean, there's always sort of energy givers and energy suckers in life, right, aren't there? And that I've been there as well, where you have the energy sucked out of a room where it's just, you as a founder, all you're trying to do is kind of put on the straps and lead, like pull the team with you and go, hey, let's go. And that time, if someone's there going like this, the other side, and pulling back on that just constantly, it wears you down. It does. It gets to that point where you can't. And it's, but yeah, it's also really difficult because you almost want to go, okay, right, your interview is 3 weeks of us working together. But obviously, like,
do you know, that you can't are so happen. Right. The amount of times I've said, what I need to be able to do is get somebody, hire them and fire them and see that entire process. Say, right, you're hired. Because it's just, even in terms of how you leave, we've had some amazing leavers, you know, that people that I would recruit back in an instant. We've had others that I think I would never, ever, you did a good job while you were here, but that last 4 weeks was the worst 4 weeks. Yeah. Of how you presented yourself. And if anyone said, how is that person? I would say, don't touch them.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because you're so right. It's that entire process. I mean, we have started taking more, I would say, more relaxed interviews, but over a prolonged period of time. So we can just see how they're behaving. I know there's that whole story that's been out there for years about taking somebody to your restaurant and seeing how they speak to a waiter or a waitress.
Yeah.
But not just that. It's like trying to get more of those values-driven questions into that everyday conversation. What would you do if this happened? How would you respond if that happened?
Yeah.
Rather than the sort of very staid interview, that just doesn't work. But neither does, and I think this is a huge issue for a lot of founders, is you go the opposite way. So you go from being this very sort of, okay, the formal doesn't work. Most of us kind of know that already.
Yeah.
But then we go too relaxed and the informal doesn't work either.
Yeah.
You have to test and iterate those sort of behaviors and find out, do you really mean that? Or are you just basically winging it? Because at the end of the day, if somebody's sales marketing, they can wing anything pretty much.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a lot to be said about asking questions outside of the work. I don't mean like literally outside. I mean sort of their wider life aspirations and what their sort of goals are and all that sort of stuff. Because it really, for me, well, for me anyway, what I found is if you find someone that is sort of has aspirations to come into a small business because they want to really get stuck in and grow the brand, and actually that's the motivation, the questions around their role and their technical abilities to actually fulfill that role are kind of then sort of null and void, because you're like, I know you're qualified because I've seen your CV. Mm. And actually, I know that if we need to drive to I don't know, 200 Sainsbury's to do some compliance checks, you're going to be in the car with me. You're not going to be like, oh, sorry, I'm in the office, I can't be bothered. And it's that, but it's such a hard balance, isn't it? And sort of getting it right is almost almost impossible, but it can be done. But I think there's almost every founder I've spoken to has had that experience whilst building the team. And I think just to your sort of point on corporate, I remember, so I used to work for Causton Press. That's where my career started. I was on the streets of, I say on the streets, it was like I was given a rucksack and we'd just go out selling, right? So we'd go into all the independents and we'd be doing demos at Whole Foods and sort of fell in love with the industry. At the time, it was very much a startup feel. We kind of, there wasn't an office, there was six or seven of us in the team, the the Alex and Jack from Dash were there, and Dan Broughton was there, and we were all set, this lovely crew. And then suddenly it got to a point where the business had really kicked on with the cans and done really well. And that was a point where they then brought in a sort of corporate MD, and it worked really well because it was already a business that had kind of gone to that scale up stage and was now like, okay, we now need to really kick on. But the process, like, it was then at a point where it needed process, and it needed those HR conversations. It needed that IT conversations. And it's finding that real fine balance between kind of, you want someone that's going to roll up the sleeves and kick some doors down for you. And then at what stage is the skill set of a corporate sort of incorporated? It's a funny one.
I think the corporate role can play an absolute key role, but it's that person, it's that spark within them that they actually want to leave, and they're not, shall we say, corporate indoctrinated. So they can't actually move beyond the confines of everything is process driven.
Yeah.
To actually, can they adapt into that scale up approach and scale up culture, but bring that, like you say, those professional rigor which needs to be in as you continue to grow. That's kind of the stage that we're at, is that sort of, okay, we've done this bit, but now some of our clients are a lot bigger, that I feel that we need additional professional rigor. And that's kind of our next step, is bringing on that senior leadership team that can sort of sit alongside like COOs and amazing. Sort of sales marketing and things like that. So yeah,
that must be a really, really exciting stage to get to that point where it's sort of at like bringing in those key people to sort of
makes me nervous.
Yeah. I can imagine
to get the right person, because I don't have time to, you know, you, and I think a lot with any scale up, you don't have the time to waste 3 months out of your calendar because you've had a bad hire, as particularly if we've got angel funding. But I know with some of the VC, well, even some of the questions that we get from angels, well, why did it take you so long to do this? But a lot of our angels are from big financial institutions anyway. Yeah. So they're like, well, it shouldn't have taken you that long. It's like, but we're a scale up.
Yeah.
And something that throws a curveball can knock your game out for 3 months.
Yeah.
And I think so I'm kind of facing the challenge with excitement and also a little bit of trepidation. Yeah. But that's the nature of the game, amazing. Isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, life's an adventure, right?
Absolutely.
There was a bit during that you were speaking about where you felt like you didn't want to go into your own office. Sort of like, obviously on Untold, I really want to kind of focus on those like tougher times and how you felt personally. Like, there was an amazing quote that I think links into this somewhere that Emma Heal said at Bread and Jam, and she'd got it from somebody else and I don't know who it is, but I will look it up and say on next episode. But and she was talking about how sort of, but like the whole conversation was around burnout and around getting to that point where you sort of don't really want to be part of it because of the culture or because of like overworking or because things have gone wrong. And the quote was around how burnout isn't how hard you work, it's about how hard you recover. And it completely shifted my mindset in everything. And I just think, like, just so before we wanted to go on, I just kind of wanted to touch on that quote, and we'll come back to it. But yeah, talk to me about how like you felt on those kind of days where it's like, and how you got past that moment personally. I guess personally, work kind of are intertwined as a founder, right? But what sort of tactics and techniques do you now look back on, like, that we can give listeners sort of tangible outcomes that go, if they go through that, actually, this is how you went through it and how you came out the other side?
Yeah, I think there's always been a few things that I constantly rely on, both in personal and professional. So a little bit of sort of personal backstory to Healthy Nibbles. My husband's involved in the business and we've got a 14-year-old daughter. So one thing we do quite frequently is we check in with each other in terms of, are the sacrifices that you are making worth the business?
Yeah.
And okay, not saying the 14-year-old controls it, but we would take it very, very seriously if it was impacting her life in a negative way. So, and likewise with any, we're literally like a trio. We come to, you know, as one.
Yeah, amazing.
And I think that that is really important. And even when I've had a really bad time, the amount of time she's come up to me and said, remember your vision, you know, it's worth it.
Oh, amazing.
You know, and so I think whatever your personal situation is, your friends, family, have those people that you can check in with.
Yeah.
Know what your limitations are. I think that's always, you know, am I getting uncomfortable in this situation? Is it a nice uncomfortable that I'm going to recover from? Or is it something that is actually so detrimental? And it isn't just the mental health. It can, for founders, it can be finance. It can be, is this, you know, as you grow a business, did you want to create a lifestyle business, or is it going, is it, you know, cannonballing into a huge entity that you don't actually want to go down that route?
Yeah.
I think always know what you're trying to create in the first place. And that's, you know, I've been very clear with this business that I want to scale and exit.
Yeah.
It's not a lifestyle business. It's too exhausting to be a lifestyle business, that's for sure. And I can think of a lot of easier ways to make the same level of money or more.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's not as well. Money's one thing, but purpose for me is absolutely something else.
Yeah.
We're B Corp. We've got a lot of sustainability accreditations. I think for me, we will do good and we will be profitable.
Amazing.
And I think holding all of those things in terms of just having that vision board, whether it's in your head, however you write it, on a practical level, I use Full Focus Planner all the time.
Yeah.
And it maps out what do you want to do for the year, breaks it down into quarters, then breaks it down into weeks and days. And I think for me, that's really good because sometimes you can look back and think, absolutely, I have done nothing over the last quarter of interest. Yeah. But then you look back over the stuff and you think, do you know what? I actually have.
Yeah. Amazing. I love that. And just quickly on that, sorry to interrupt you.
No.
But, again, it was Emma Heal who was speaking about this, but she said that she looks, we were talking about kind of work-life balance and how you find that balance. And she said that she looks at it on a more macro level. So she'll look at her year and she'll make sort of goals based. And this is something that I've never done, but I'm absolutely going to start doing, is looking at kind of got like tangible goals that she wants throughout the year. So she'll say, I want to make sure I have 4 weeks dedicated holiday, not necessarily abroad, but just holiday, where I spend every single minute of that, those 4 weeks with my kids. And I know I've got that to look forward to. And I know that every week on a daily basis, once a week, I want to be at the school gates to pick them up and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it was amazing because I think to your point of, it comes that almost kind of making sure that when you're checking in, it's also about that element of controlling what it is that you want from life. And if it's on that day to day, like I found myself previously on a day to day, just playing catch up, and I'm not doing what I want to do. I'm doing something that it has to happen because the fire's gone off here or something's happened there. And you're like, actually coming away, that the program that you mentioned sounds amazing, to really sort of condense that down and sort of get control of what it is and where it is it's going.
Yeah, it is very good because it doesn't just look at your business goals. It looks at, you put it into the work, the personal, health and fitness, into spiritual and into family or family and connections. So it says, what are you going to achieve this week for social interaction? What are you going to achieve for your health and fitness? And I'm a big believer in, I don't know if any of you, if you've read it, but there's a book called Atomic Habits.
Yeah.
Yeah, where it's just those little changes. So, you know, your health goals might literally just be to get enough water in and to get, you know, to eat properly. I'm one of these people that go all or nothing for eating when I'm under stress.
Yeah,
if the stress gets too much, I don't touch anything. If it's midway, I would probably clear out the cupboard. not good when you've got a snack business because it's like, okay,
there's a lot in the cupboard.
it doesn't deplete. you know, so I think it's knowing what your challenges are, what your weak points are. But back to what you were saying as far as Emma, that's quite true because this looks at your goals. It says, don't do more than 10 goals a year.
Yeah.
And don't just focus on the business one. So, you know, if you're in debt, it might be to get out of financial debt.
Yeah, you know,
it could be to take that holiday. It could be to sit with your kids and do their homework, or, you know, to check in with different friends each week. So it constantly focuses. Now, I'm not saying I do all of them. There's quite often with my social, scrap a line through it, because it's just like I do not have the headspace to connect to it. So there's no way that I'm going to be on here saying, yeah, I managed to brilliantly hit all the targets. I absolutely don't. And do have weeks where you have 4 hours sleep and it just feels like a hamster wheel and you've just got to get on and get off as quick as you can.
Yeah.
And then other days you do, or other weeks you'll have time where you can take half an afternoon off and it feels like a holiday.
Absolutely.
The balance is not there, but at least it's a tool to sort of bring me back to that.
Yeah, amazing. And I was listening to Stephen Bartlett's podcast the other day with Bear Grylls, and he was saying that he almost, like, to your point about saying how it's okay to not, like, you're not going to get everything done on that list. And he was saying that he draws a line between family and work. And he says, like, some stuff that he gets asked to do, he'll obviously go and do, and some stuff he won't, because he takes time for family. But actually what he does is he moves the line further towards his family, so it's not halfway, because that way he knows he's going to overcommit, and it comes back, it then mills out. And it's similar to what you're saying. It's almost kind of not overachieving is the wrong word, but getting to a point where you know that some of them aren't going to happen and you're okay with that, rather than, because I guess there's some listeners out there who will be almost too much and then beat themselves up about the fact that they haven't done it, so which then creates even more stress, right? So I guess it's sort of finding that balance of how to manage that and how to use it as a kind of North Star, but know it's okay to kind of sort of waver a little bit, but as long as the North Star's there eventually.
I think it's also, I would add on this, because obviously the very essence of what you talk about is the challenges. My personal challenge is I overwork 100%, and I could quite easily go days without moving from the desk. And I wouldn't know who's been in the house, who's left, whether anyone's eaten, whether my daughters are even arrived home. I literally go so inward. And I did see there's Amanda Thompson, who runs Thompson and Scott and Naughty. And she had said about that sort of where you can just get so focused. I think she shared something around ADHD and mental behaviors of a lot of founders. And I think there's an element of that in a lot of the behavior traits of founders, because 100%. You have to be a certain type of person to say, okay, I'm blanking out everything. You know, I've missed so many social events. I've worked more than 7 days a week, just literally constant. And I think eventually you do realize you can't do it all. And hopefully you realize you can't do it all before you completely burn out and it ruins the future. And I'm not going to sort of sit here and say you need to work out where that is, because I think it just suddenly, for me, it just suddenly happened that, you know, am I going to end up dead, basically, if I carry on the way I'm going? And actually, who gives a monkeys if I am dead, you know? If I'm working like this, you know, do you, it's not to say that my ambition is not, I'm always, you know, 100% achieve 110%. So it does great against me, but I think you've got to know what type of person you are. I know I've spoken to other people where they overwhelmed and they just do absolutely nothing. Then they just can't move. So it's knowing what you are and how to respond to that, and then working out what's useful for you.
And also, I guess, like, Ollie Hiscox has a really, the founder of Ollie's, he has a really good mentality to this, which he calls net enjoyment. And he's like, yes, there's some really shitty times, yes, there's some amazing times, but as long as you net out as enjoying the ride, that's what matters. Because I mean, when you start a business, particularly in food and drink, I think it's not necessarily the same in tech and some other kind of slightly faster moving industries, but in sort of FMCG, particularly food and drink, when you start something, you know you're strapping in for a good 8 to 10 years minimum, right? Yeah. And therefore, if you're not, if the goal and the traits, I completely agree with. There's always a like a chase element, right? It's always kind of like I want the next, I want the next, I want the next. And I remember my wife sitting down with me when we a couple of years ago when we got one of our first listings with Whole Foods Market, and I'd said to her, so 2 years prior to that, I was like, God, when we eventually launch, I'd absolutely love to be stocked in Whole Foods. And she, bless her, when we got the listing, she, bless her, had organised like a little dinner at home and we were going to celebrate the Whole Foods. And I came back really late. She was like, where on earth are you? I was like, I'm working on my Sainsbury's proposal. And had just not even like registered about that. Like, I mean, it's great, right? Whole Foods is fantastic. I love working with them. They're still a customer, but you almost go right, tick, bang, next, what's next? And there's just that constant chase of it. And actually, I think sort of secretly deep down, and this is why I love the chats about the harder times, because it's not to put people off, it's to bring the reality into it. Because I think secretly deep down, a lot of founders just love that chase. And it's the end goal is like kind of, like you've openly said that it is to scale and ideally exit at some point, right? But guaranteed, sort of, I don't know, a few weeks after that, you'll probably go, "Oh, what's next?" And like, it's that element of it, isn't it? And it's sort of learning, as you've said so eloquently, kind of learning how to find those that like make sure you're on track to just enjoying life. And I think it's, don't want to look back and go, bloody hell, that's 10 years and kind of blinked and it's gone, and making sure that net enjoyment and just enjoying the ride is there for the win.
Yeah, you know, one of my investors actually said that to me. He said, you just got to learn to enjoy the ride.
Yeah.
And I would say I've had two nuggets that I think have absolutely helped me so much. That was one. And the other was, remember it's your business. And that's when you're getting so many different perspectives, because everybody's got a perspective on how you should be running your business.
Yeah.
I was recently in a shareholders meeting, and the perspectives from just seven of them was so, so different.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I took all of your thoughts on board, you know, actually, if you brought all of that onto a piece of paper, that wouldn't be feasible for one person to do. So what are you expecting me to do with that?
Yeah.
And, you know, in past, we've been bullied by an investor. And actually, just being able to turn around and say, do you know what? That's your perspective now, out of the way, because I'm doing it my way. That's it. Yeah. You invested. You know, it's not my fault.
I mean, that's
the founder that you invested in.
I mean, that is such amazing advice, because it's so easy as a founder to kind of almost be slightly rabbit in a headlights, because because of the sheer way that it works, fundraising and going out to find them. Then when you get them, they're kind of put on this pedestal of like, wow, these are the people that I wanted to wow so badly. But actually, it's exactly what you said, trying to get to that point where you go, no, like, you backed me. This isn't like, the power has changed from me chasing you to now actually you sit down and I'll listen to you when I'm ready to listen to you, but I'm not going to do it. I'm not a puppet. It's an amazing.
And I actually said this recently to an investor, that this is, you know, we have to have this open and transparent conversation, because ultimately you're going to be with me for the next 5 to 6 years at least.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have to get on. It's like a mini marriage.
Yeah.
But you know, you wouldn't, and we don't culturally, we don't accept that you can be in an abusive relationship.
Yeah.
It's not the right way to be.
Yeah.
So equally, don't abuse your perceived power on me, but equally, I'm respectful that you're also dealing with so many different founders. You'll have seen so many different success stories and a lot of failures in your time. So if we can collaboratively share those experiences, then it's powerful.
Yeah.
100%. If the dial swings either way, it's not.
Yeah. And I think as well, it's there's an element, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, the element of kind of trusting your gut as to what you listen to. Like, if you know within one sentence that it's going to be worthwhile advice, right? I there's that gut moment of going, okay, A, this bloke speaks sense. B, he's looking after me as a founder. And C, he's looking after this business and this sounds really right. You kind of, like, would you agree? Is that something that kind of has happened? And
yeah, I mean, we have removed a chairman because it was a bullying tactic.
Yeah.
And it was incessant. And that to me was, I actually got to the point where I was not fearful. I was just angsty.
Yeah.
For about a week before a meeting and a week after. A week before, like, what on earth can he say now? A week after with, I can't believe that that's what he thought.
Yeah.
You know? those time frames then started to get to that point. And then it was one of my other investors that gave me this. He introduced me to somebody who was got a coaching program. And she's now actually just joined as a non-exec. But she said to me, I never forget when she said, just remember it's your business. And I think there is that, because you know why you founded it. You know what your motivation is. You know the end goal. And I think all of that does link back to, like you're saying, are you speaking sense?
Yeah.
We do get people that, investors and advisors, where they've come from environments that are not as complex and challenging. We look really easy on the surface. You know, we send out boxes, we send sort of a food service concierge, we do the automated retail, looks dead easy. You just put snacks in different solutions. But actually the logistics around it, and the data around it, and all of those different challenges, and obviously working with challenger brands, they experience their own challenges, which then impact on us, some of them.
Yeah.
But you know what you're dealing with. Reasons that we prefer not working through wholesalers, and we prefer working direct, because actually we can get a direct relationship, so we know the ebbs and flows of stock and relationships.
Amazing. Yeah.
But I think you know all of that, so you know whether that advice is relevant and whether they're trying to put their own personal opinion on you without having the insight. You're running the shop day to day.
I
think, you know, there's great advice out there, there's terrible advice out there. And I have a huge sense of reliance on my gut, on faith as well, because I have faith, I'm Christian, so I have a faith-based belief as well.
Yeah.
That I just rely on that so much to define a lot of the decisions that I make, whilst also taking on board the expertise that is out there, because there's some phenomenal people that actually, if you do listen to, and you'll know who they are in your own world, if you listen to them, they can fast track your journey like that, because they can overcome so many hurdles. But it's finding that balance, definitely. Not being cajoled either way.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's so true, because everyone's got an opinion, right? I remember, and we've got a new, and some MPD launching, and we went into but so when we were doing the kind of basic bones of sort of like, do our consumers gonna like this product, we went into like sort of various stores, and the second you start saying, oh yeah, like this is my business and this is a product that we're about to launch, like, even people who have no idea who I am, who, what the business is, what the food industry is, how, like, we're in sampling, and the retailer very kindly allowed us to sample this MPD product before we'd launched it, or before we launch it. And they don't even know how the product that is behind me on shelf would have got to that shelf. Yet suddenly they're an expert in what they think we should do, or what type of flavor should be done, or what. And that, I mean, that's on a completely other scale. But it does just go to show, like, but then there might be someone that comes in and you go, wow, actually, that's actually quite good. Why haven't I thought of that? So it's like, it's so individual with, and I think it's like everything in life with advice. Like, advice is, it's like, it's very specific to what you're going through at that time. Like, someone could give you a bit of advice now, give you the same advice next year, and now it's useless, but next year it's amazing. And it's like, it's a sliding, moving scale, I guess.
Yeah, it is. And it's knowing who you are, it's knowing what you're wanting to achieve, it's knowing what your values are. All of those different things, both personally and professionally, play a huge part in the relevance of the advice.
Yeah, amazing.
Personalities then add, you know, if you clash with somebody, they can maybe be offering the best advice in the world, but if you clash on a personality level, you might take it. So I think it's just being open to advice, open to expertise, but also knowing your parameters. And that I think that just takes personal time. I mean, I'm in my 40s, so not a young entrepreneur, but I do think actually there's an element of, all right, pipe down now.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have said as a 20-year-old.
Absolutely. I think that's amazing. And I think there's a lot of, I'm conscious of time. I'll start to wrap it up, but I think there's a lot of founders out there that are, and it's refreshing to hear from you saying stuff like that, pipe down, because there's a lot of founders, including myself, that always want to try and give the kind of carrot. And actually there's 100% times where you just have to give the stick. And if you don't, it's not, it, like, I mean, obviously not literally, but like, it's not, it's not, yeah. And I think that's amazing. Well, look, just before we start to wrap up, I'd love to kind of, I always love to end these chats on kind of the positive sides and like the positivity and the excitement and the energy that's going on. So talk us a little bit about what's happening next. And I'd also love it if you could maybe tell our listeners how they would go about following you, how they would maybe go about sort of showing, getting their products over to you. Like, give us that kind of roundup.
So the most exciting thing this year for me, one of the most exciting things is actually I've just finished the Goldman Sachs 10K program.
Hey.
Absolutely phenomenal. Wow.
Amazing.
And what that does, or what that has done for me, and certainly a lot of the peers that were on the course, it gives you the opportunity to step away from the business and really focus on what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah.
So, and you also get grilled by numerous other founders in lots of different sectors. So you're not just focused on, just the food or just whatever.
Yeah.
So different perspectives in the room all the time. So your business sort of vision gets basically broken down into smithereens and rebuilt back up in a really clean way. So that's been really phenomenal for me, because I felt that the business has got to that challenge point of what do we do and where do we sit and how do we position ourselves?
Yeah.
We now have three very, very cool revenue channels, which I'm really excited because they just meet the needs of the growing diversity of where everybody is, because everyone's all over the place now because we're not all in work or at home or whatever. Yeah. So we've got vending and automated cafes, which are brilliant.
Yeah.
We've got snack boxes and corporate gifting, and we've got food service concierge, which is basically an elevated wholesale experience.
Amazing. So
if a business is looking to get healthy food on site, but they, you know, we've got one site where they're paying nearly £4 for a 26-gram bar of chocolate.
Yeah.
Another site where everything is round pound because we're dealing with different demographics.
Yeah, amazing.
So, and then we've got an MVP in data and retail analytics coming to market soon.
Wow.
So we're in a really good position that we're not doing any more sort of groundbreaking innovation in terms of where we're heading and just really building up these four key areas.
Great.
We've got some really exciting clients that we'll be able to announce soon.
Amazing. Amazing.
Can't say it. It's tight-lipped at the moment. And I think we've really nailed what our vision and our values are and all of that sort of stuff. So I think it's a really positive time.
Yeah,
fantastic. In that sense. So that's been the good stuff. I would say if people are wanting to get in touch, so the first thing we look at is go onto our website and look at the non-negotiables.
Yeah.
We don't deviate. So if your product has any of those in, then we don't work with brands that do.
Yeah.
After that, we generally look at samples and price points to get a real understanding. I would say keep briefs short about, you know, obviously we get a lot of passionate founders and some of them have got the most amazing backstories, but in the nicest way, we don't have an hour on the phone on day one.
Yeah, of course. All time to read an essay of an email, right?
Exactly. So, you know, why are you cool and why are you different? Very similar to an investor pitch, probably, in that sense.
Yeah.
When we know that the price point's right and the taste, because taste is absolutely key for us, we don't just want healthy food. We want healthy food that tastes brilliant, that converts behavior,
or
changes behavior. We've then got a form that basically goes through all the basics in terms of size, weights, measurements, dietaries. And then we also look at the sustainability side.
Amazing.
So what are you doing as far as carbon emissions, how are you tracking that? Because obviously that is crucial for us, but we're finding we're having to sort of like stand in the gap and support around that. So, you know, familiarization with what B Corp stands for and how you as a supplier could impact us.
Yeah.
And we don't expect every supplier to be on that journey, because some are, some aren't. You know, you mentioned Ollie, we work with Ollie's. You know, we work with lots of the startup brands. Progressing startup, because they're not really just startup. You know, like Insane Grain and you know, lots of really cool brands. So we don't expect everyone to tick every box, but we do expect you to position yourself in terms of health, sustainability, and behavior change.
Yeah, amazing. And I think as well that the sort of people that are listening to this podcast, if the sustainability element isn't, it doesn't have to be front and center and everyone's shouting about it, but if it's not on the cards within the next 5 years, it's kind of, it absolutely should be anyway.
Exactly. And I do think that's going to be key for so many products, because what I do see in the industry is this squeeze point at the moment where we're reporting on all of our scope 1, 2, and 3, but then we can't fully report on them because then the smaller brands in the market don't have that. So there is going to be that push on, you need to start doing something, fall in that direction, even if you haven't done it completely. So yeah, and then just reaching out to hello at Healthy Nibbles, or we've got a form online, or connect to me personally. So I'm on LinkedIn.
Amazing. That's fantastic. And remember, when you're listening, don't hound. I've been there before, where I've just hounded buyers, and there's a sort of fine balance between, I guess, hounding and kind of going a bit too far. But look,
and patience from the product producer side. I can publicly apologize, because there's probably a lot of listeners on here that are also suppliers. But I think, like we're talking now, there's challenges to the business. And I think sometimes when we have the challenges, it's like, is it an essential I need to answer this email? So sometimes if we're not taking a new brand on, then we don't answer. No. It doesn't mean to say you're forgotten. I actually file every single one of my brand introductions, so I can go through and then categorize them into sweet, savory, and all that sort of stuff, so that I've got a list to go back to. Because some products, you know, we need to look at suitability. Does it dispense from a vending machine? Or what are the price points if it is going into food service concierge? The other side, if we get a luxury product, then it can go in our Christmas or our seasonal hampers.
Yeah.
So I'm constantly thinking about where could it be placed.
Yeah. There you go. Patience. Amazing. Well, I could sit here and chat. There's so many bits we can unpick and chat for hours, but that's absolutely not feasible. So Sarah, thank you so much for coming on. It's been absolutely fantastic to sort of get, like, I've followed your journey for years, so it's great to sort of put a face to a name and have a chat on a personal level. But then obviously I know there's so many tangibles there that we've covered that our listeners will be able to take away. So thank you so much for your time and being brave enough to kind of open up and tell your story.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
Great, guys. Thank you all so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Keep jiggling. Bye. Thank you so much for listening to Untold. As always, we are so grateful that you give us a little bit of your time.
We really, really are. And as ever, please do give us some feedback. We love it. So any reviews, please subscribe, obviously, as well. It helps us with the old ratings position in the podcast, wherever you download them. But please do let us know what you thought of the episode. We love to hear what you guys think.
And as always, this episode is brought to you by The Savourist. We make lip-smackingly delicious savoury snacks that can be found at www.thesavourist.com or the.savourist on Instagram and TikTok. Ciao for now. See you next time.